You got Dick, you got Lay, and you got Colin. You got Bush, you got Dick, you got Lay, and you got Colin. You got Bush, you got Dick, you got Lay, and you got Colin. Turn the world into one big Texas. 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 Red lights are flashing, a code red in the news. Kicks are getting swollen, you better cut the laces loose. The top begins to crumble, the beacon starts to fall. Voices echo past me down an intricate hall. Shadows in the bathroom, shadows on the stall. Black boots marching with a back against the wall. Sirens crease the moonlight and the rain comes pouring down. Flooding down in Houston, fires in the town. Yeah, read it in the paper, hear it on the radio. We've got Texas steam and it's ready to blow. He's making his play, don't get in his way. Or you'll hear from Ashcroft and the CIA. He's turning the world into one big Texas. Turning the world into one big Texas. Turning the world into one big Texas. Yeah, turning the world into one big Texas. Take a look around this in the shit. Yeah, they did it again. Another negative spin on that CNN. You gotta fight them with your music. You gotta fight them with your pen. You gotta fight them with the phone calls and the letters that you send. Cause there's additional cracks in the Liberty Bell. Yeah, the water's running low in the American well. We gotta burn down the brush. You gotta turn up the heat. You gotta book a flight to Crawford and buy a front row seat. Because W's got a mission, and W's got a plan. Yeah, W's got his pistol, and it's burning in his hand. He's turning the world into one big Texas.
What's this?
Turning the world into one big Texas. Turning the world into one big Texas. Turning the world into one big Texas. We got Texas tornadoes, Texas blues, Texas cowboys, and Texas news, Texas rangers, Texas food, and Texas overflowing with GW's crude. Give me a T for Texas, and a T for traitor. Give me a T for terrible, and a current dictator.
I got a
T for twisted, and a T for truth, and a T for the tornado that they just set loose. Cause he's turning the world into one big Texas. 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 You got Bush, you got Dick, you got Lay, and you got Colin. You got Bush, you got Dick, you got Lay, and you got Colin. You got Bush.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Rachel Levinson-Wallman talk to Scott Horton about the excessive power that the federal government has.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sorry that we're out of time. Half an hour always goes so fast.
and there's still so much to talk about, but there's a dispute right now. I don't know if you cover this in your piece. I'm sorry I didn't get that far, but is it clear or not yet whether the metadata, the phone metadata there, includes your phone's location everywhere you go to? Because I always wonder whether they follow me to the living room and back, you know, or follow me to the kitchen. You know, yeah, there, look, he went to the kitchen again.
Right, what's he doing in there? That's a really good question. This has absolutely been an issue of major debate. My sense from what we know so far is that this database probably doesn't include location information. The NSA has said that they did a several years long experiment with gathering location information. They abandoned it in 2011, but Senator Wyden, who is a senator on the Intelligence Committee, he's basically been sending up smoke signals saying there is more there that they're not telling you. Right. So I think we know that there's more to learn about the NSA gathering location information. We just don't quite know which program it's sitting in.
Right. Yeah, I do know from Bamford's book back when, before any of the Snowden stuff came out, that after they closed down Total Information Awareness under Admiral Poindexter, that they just moved it to the NSA and renamed it Basketball. And I guess they cut it in thirds, and then they made up names for the new things, too. But and just, oh, you don't like the thing that we're doing? We'll just make it more secret and then continue.
Right, right.
That's their regular modus operandi or whatever. All right, anyway, so I'm sorry that we're all out of time because I wanted to ask you about the border searches and the Five Eyes loophole and all of this stuff. There's all kinds of stuff, but you're on my list of NSA experts now, so thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate it. Take care.
All right, everybody, that's Rachel Levinson Waldman. She's counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program at the New York School of Law.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Who's afraid of the sun? Who would question the goodness of the mighty? We who banish the threat. When your little ones all go nighty-nighty, well, there's no time for doubt right now and less time to explain. So get back on your horses, kiss my ring, join our next campaign, and the empire grows with the news that we're winning, with more fear to conquer and more gold thread for spinning, bright as the sun, shining on everyone. Some would say that we forced our words, and we find that ingenuously churlish. Words are just words. Don't be so pessimistic, weak and girlish. We like strong, happy people who don't think there's something wrong with pride. Work makes them free, and we spread that freedom far and wide, and the empire grows the seeds of its glory. For every five tanks, plant a sentimental story till they worship the sun, even Christ loving ones. And we'll kill the terrorizers and a million of their races. But when don't question the sun, it doesn't help anyone. But the journalist cried out when it was too late to stop us. Everyone had awakened to the dream they could enter our colossus. And now I'm right, yeah, you said I'm right. There's nothing that can harm me, cause the sun never sets on my dungeons or my army. And the empire fell on its own splintered axis, and the emperor wanes as the silver moon waxes, and the farmers will find all coins in their strawberry fields, while some
as the recent UN negotiations remind us, solving the climate crisis has become a massive undertaking involving the whole world. But a new study shows that most of the global warming emissions that led to the present situation come from just 90 enterprises. Richard Heedy of the Climate Accountability Institute in Colorado led a team that compiled the data that reveals just which entities supplied fossil fuels from the start of the Industrial Revolution to the present. He joins me now on the line. Welcome to Living on Earth.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Steve.
So why did you do this project? What got you started with this research?
Well, because we wanted to, in essence, trace most of humanity's emissions of carbon dioxide and methane that come from industrial sources, such as fossil fuel consumption, back to the extracting entities that had started the whole process. So we looked at a threshold of 8 million tons of carbon per year in a recent year for the major entities, oil and gas and coal producers, as well as cement producers, and looked back over their historical self-reported production so we can base it on their own reported data.
Now, all this research looks like it involved a massive amount of work. How were you able to do all of this?
Steve, I had colleagues at various universities, at Cambridge, at the British Library in London, in Sydney, in Johannesburg, Berkeley, to look at collections of annual reports housed in business libraries. Unfortunately, most of them aren't cataloged, so we had to go in person to the dusty stacks and find the old reports for most of these investor-owned companies going back to the early 1900s, sometimes even earlier than that.
Tell me about your process and what it was like, and how did you account for emissions from the 1800s?
So we take their produced fuels, reported either in annual reports or in company histories and other sources, and we know how much carbon is in oil and gas fairly accurately. We also wanted to track how much carbon was in the coals, because that varies by heating value and coal rank. So we document as carefully as possible what kind of fuel and where it was produced, so we can track the carbon from the fuels produced into what was actually combusted by consumers. And for that, we had to also deduct for non-energy uses of fossil fuels, particularly petroleum, that goes into petrochemicals and lubricants and wax, because we want to deduct for the carbon stored in long-lived products and just focus on tracing the emissions to the atmosphere back to the fuels produced.
So after all this review, what exactly did you find?
We found that for these 90 entities that we call carbon majors, 81 of which are investor-owned or state-owned corporations, that they had produced 63% of all the carbon emitted to the atmosphere since 1751, and we traced each fuel to each company.
So how was that distributed throughout these 90 entities?
They were fairly evenly divided between the 9 government-run industries in Poland, for example, in the coal industry, coal produced in China. So there you have nation states in 9 cases, former Soviet Union, for example. And we also have 31 state-owned oil and gas companies like Saudi Aramco and Pemex, and 50 investor-owned companies such as Shell and BP and Eni and Total that we all know about.
So who were the largest polluters?
The largest investor-owned and state-owned companies are Chevron and ExxonMobil, followed by Gazprom and Saudi Aramco and Shell and BP, roughly in that order.
And together they account for what percentage of overall emissions, would you say?
Well, if we take the top 10, they're responsible for about 13% together. If we take all the investor-owned companies, they're responsible for 22% of all global emissions of CO2 since 1751. And the largest of that is Chevron, and they're 3.5%.
How many of these companies are still operating today?
Nearly all of them. We did trace some of the emissions back to companies whose assets upon dissolution, like British Coal, we weren't able to trace to existing companies. But almost all of these companies are still in existence, in part because we tried to include mergers and acquisitions by the existing companies. So Chevron, for example, has merged with Texaco in the early 2000s. Texaco and Chevron absorbed Getty Oil and Gulf Oil, etc. So we try to include previous companies that were merged or absorbed.
What do you make of this finding? It seems like an awfully small number.
You can fit the directors and presidents of these entities on 2 Greyhound buses. It's a small number, and it highlights that there are just a few dozen individuals and boards of corporations that can make different choices in dealing with solving the climate. I think they can have a vast positive influence on how we deal with climate change. We have to seize the opportunity now to get their help in solving the problem, as opposed to just being passive and profitable bystanders to continued climate destabilization. And I think shareholders will all notice which of these companies become leaders in the climate change arena and which become laggards, and we can choose between the two more wisely.
In the end, what do you hope comes out of your research?
That we focus more attention on how to deal with existing proven reserves. We have three times as much in proven reserves as the atmosphere can afford to absorb to protect climate stability. And of course, the international climate negotiations have a very positive role to play here. But so do producers who have the ear of politicians, as well as of their shareholders, and can influence how resources are produced and distributed and used. And we have a data set now of 90 entities, what kind of fuels and emissions are traceable to them year by year. So it will be a useful way to devise a metric on how to reduce emissions in the future. Maybe there's some obligation by the 90 carbon majors to reduce their emissions over time in concordance with their historic emissions in the past.
Rick Heaty is the co-director of the Climate Accountability Institute. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
Thanks. It was my pleasure, Steve.
And I'm here to introduce my husband, the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Hi, sweetheart. How are you?
Well, Pumpkinhead, I'm a little upset. I've been reading in the papers that people still think I misused information from the CIA to justify my war with Iraq.
That's all right, darling. The CIA director defended you. He said you were simply lacking the proper intelligence.
But you know, honey, these are difficult times to be the president. The situation in Iraq just keeps getting dangeroser and dangeroser. And it is very much a time of scariness. It is a time of evildoers. It is a time to reestablish peace talks with all kinds of world leaders. Leaders like, yes, sir, are you fat?
Well, I have to say, darling, you're taking it all very well. Just like you took it all so well just today when so many people went out and protested your war with Iraq.
Yeah. Well, honey, I couldn't be too concerned about what the American people think. I mean, hell, most of them didn't even vote for me anyway. But you must never forget that war begins with W. But I'm still upset, honey. I keep asking the UN for help in rebuilding Iraq, and they just don't take me seriously. It seems that all our allies all are quitting.
I think they'll come along.
Hope it's soon.
But you've got the support of Spain and Britain.
And Cameroon.
The Russians are resisting with all their force.
The Germans wouldn't send even one platoon. But thankfully we're counting on the Air Force of Cameroon.
Cameroon. Cameroon.
I called them up to just say thanks.
That was nice.
Cameroon. Cameroon.
I hear they're sending both their tanks. Next year you'll face election, it's worth noting.
And if we get to April, May, or June,
if all the troops aren't back
and we're still in Iraq, my chances will be better if I run in Cameroon.
Thank you. It was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. And when the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried after the revolution. Prison doors swung open, mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air, and Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now after the revolution. Debts were all forgiven in all the neo-colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees after the revolution. Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Solar panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks. Organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks. And all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Bill Gates was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm after the revolution. Political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11 home beneath the covers. And I learned how to play accordion after the revolution.
It's the Onion Radio News. Genetically modified broccoli shrieks its benefits at passing shoppers. This is Doyle Redland reporting. A head of genetically modified broccoli loudly proclaimed its 40% vitamin A advantage over non-modified broccoli to shoppers in a Seattle area Safeway today. The scientifically engineered mass of health-giving florets had this to screech repeatedly at terrified onlookers in the produce aisle.
I can fight off insects and disease without the use of pesticides!
The Screaming Broccoli's creator, Monsanto, has issued a statement that genetic modification technology is still in its infancy and that more pleasantly voiced broccoli should hit store shelves by 2003. Doyle Redland for the Onion Radio News.
This election is a referendum on Obama. You're getting sleepy. Obama is a sellout to the right. you're getting sleepy. There's no difference between the parties, except, you know, the war on women, the war on science, the war on minorities, the war on gay people, the war on labor, the threat of war in Iran, and the entire judiciary, including the Supreme Court, for generations. Now, when I count to three and snap my fingers, you won't vote, and that's perhaps the most effective way to vote Republican.
And now for something completely different.